My name is Daniel Bowers Kennedy. I'm 68 years old. I'm a native of Pennsylvania. I was with the 1st Squadron Air 17th Cavalry, and before that, I was part of the 82nd Airborne Division. And before that, I was with the 6th Armored Cavalry Regiment. I attained the rank of captain, and I was an Army aviator.
Okay. Now, can you please describe to me what your thoughts were before the war started, during the war, and after the war ended, and if they changed, if so, how?
Well, I have had no opinion about the war before it started. During the Vietnam War, I was, quite frankly, more afraid of dying than I was of anything else. I mean, my focus was on staying alive. And after the war ended, I realized what a complete and utter waste of life it was. We accomplished nothing and sacrificed, what, 57,000 people. So yeah, I think we're stupid.
Okay. So to kind of go off a little bit off of that, you said war is stupid, but what else comes to mind when you think of war? Like, can you just start from war is and go from there?
If you've ever seen the Vietnam Memorial, that's what I think of war. All those names. And some of them were my friends. And if we're going to go to war, I think you have to go to war in order to win it, not just to prove a political point. So what do I think of war now? I just think of the men that I served with who died.
Now, the United States once had a system of recruiting young men to go into the military. It was less than voluntary. So can you tell us what that process was called and how it worked and how it impacted you as a young man?
You're talking about selective service?
Yeah.
The draft?
Mm-hmm.
It impacted me in that I wanted to get my commission rather than be drafted as a private. That's how it affected me. I wanted a better life than, you know, just a grunt.
For some people who don't know what the draft is, can you just, how would you describe the draft to like a 4-year-old?
It's to a 4-year-old. I have a 4-year-old granddaughter. I'll pretend she's
maybe,
here.
Maybe 12-year-old.
12-year-old, sorry. Just threw that out there.
Everybody is required to register for the draft at age 18. All men are required to. And then you're given a number, and that number is in turn called upon to determine whether you're going to be drafted or not. If you get a high number, you're less likely to get drafted. You get a low number, you're likely to get drafted. We haven't had a draft in a long time, though, now. But I think men are still required to register.
Can you just think back for a moment when you were told that you were going to be sent to Vietnam? What was going through your mind?
Well, I was with the 6th Armored Cavalry Regiment at the time, and my position was as an assistant adjutant, and I created the order sending a lot of guys to Vietnam. When I got the call from Armor Branch saying that they had orders for Daniel Kennedy to go to Vietnam, my first thought was, oh, crap, you know. Didn't want to go, but you know, just the luck of the draw, you get orders, you do what you have to do.
Okay. I know you mentioned before that your orders got rescinded. Why do you think that was? What was going through your mind? How did you react?
When I was told that my orders for Vietnam were canceled,
back up? I'm sorry. So, because I think we're jumping into something that won't be clear to know someone who is not in the pre-interview. Did you go to Vietnam, and if not, why, and how did that process occur?
I did not go to Vietnam. I was with the 6th Armored Cavalry Regiment when I got my orders to go to Vietnam. And sometime after that, I forget how long it was, my orders were rescinded, and I was told I was not going to go to Vietnam. I think what happened is that I was darn good at my job as an assistant adjutant, And the colonel who was in charge of the regiment relied upon me a great deal. And I think he called Armor Branch and said, don't send this guy. Let him stay here. That's what my feeling is. And how did I feel? Relieved. I only knew one guy who actually wanted to go to Vietnam. And he wanted to go because he wanted to be a hero. He didn't get killed. He was in my class at Washington Jefferson College. He retired as a full colonel, but he was no hero.
So kind of go back a little bit. When you attended college, were you in the ROTC program?
Yes. That's how I got my commission.
Which branch? Oh, I'm sorry. You were in the Army. Well, how would you describe the training that you received at ROTC?
Minimal. It was like all of the training I received except for my flight training. I don't think it prepared me for combat or leadership particularly. Flight training, I think it was the best in the world.
When did you begin flight training? How did that come about?
I applied for it. I wanted the flight pay. And I was accepted for it, and I actually enjoyed flight training. It's true, I'm terrified of heights. So I had to overcome something, you know, in order to become an aviator. But the training we received, we even trained the Air Force helicopter pilots and foreign nationals. It was very good training.
Now, just go back real quick. I know you mentioned before that when you were in ROTC, you wanted to kill everybody. What did you mean by that?
Well, after the war started, I probably overstated that. I wanted to get the job done. You know, I wanted the war to get over. And that would have meant, we used to joke that there were millions of people wanting to kill each other, kill us. And it was true, you know. But I just wanted to get the job done and get it over with.
Okay, so you said that you felt like people should go to the war to get the job done. What did you feel was the job that needed to get done by going to Vietnam, and how did you feel about that?
Well, at the time, I was young. I was 21. And my idea of war was just to kill the enemy. There's a lot you don't know when you're a brand new second lieutenant. So yes, I did want to, if I was going to go over there, I wanted to just kill all the enemy I could.
Okay, now considering you did not go to Vietnam and considering the outcome of the war, how do you think you would have impacted the turnout had you gone to Vietnam?
I honestly don't know. I know I would have done my job, whatever job I was assigned. And hopefully I would have done it in a way that would have made the service proud.
Okay. Let's see. Earlier you said that you had no desire to go to combat. Did you have a desire for anything? Like, why did you decide to stay in the service, despite the fact that your orders were rescinded?
It was the best 7 years of my life, my active duty time. I loved being an adjutant and an assistant adjutant. With the 6th Cavalry, I took care of the personnel needs of 3,000 men. With the 1st of the 17th Cavalry, I took care of the needs of a squadron of 1,000 men, all of their personnel needs. And it's very satisfying to be the person that people come to for help when they're in trouble, when they need something, and you can fulfill that need.
Okay, now as personnel, I know you mentioned that you were the one who were making the phone calls, sending people to Vietnam. Did you feel like you were, I wouldn't say selfish, but did you feel like just bad in a way, considering you did not, you knew for a fact that you did not want to be there, but you were the one making the phone call? How did you feel about that?
Well, it wasn't my call. I don't know why I remember this major's name. His name was Major Rice at Armor Branch. He would make the decision as to who would go and where they'd go based on the needs of the service. I would just be the one who drafted the order and made the call to another officer and give them the bad news.
Can you describe one of those calls if you remember it, or do you remember
it? Oh, I remember one vividly.
Any kind of responses that people had to it?
I remember one vividly. Jimmy Carney was my best friend in the 6th Cavalry. He worked one floor below me. He and his wife and me and my wife, we went out to dinner a lot together, piled around. When I got the call from Armor Branch that he was going to go to Vietnam, I walked downstairs and said, "Jimmy, I got to tell you something." And he knew immediately what it was. And I felt really crappy about that. I never talked to him again after that, after he left.
Why not?
He was wounded in Vietnam, I knew that. And then he got out, and I tried to find him several times. And I finally found out that he was the head of the park program for the state of Nebraska. And I tried to call him a couple times. I could never get him.
Do you think, like, why do you think that was, though? Like, do you think he was just upset at you, or?
No, I don't think he was mad at me. I just think the war changed him.
Why do you think the war changed him?
Because he was my best friend, and I never got in touch with him again. He never tried to find me.
Mm-hmm. Going back to pilot training, why did you choose to become a pilot? And I know you mentioned before that your wingmen were damn good pilots. Why would you consider you guys damn good pilots?
And if you could just clarify, I'm not sure about the pilot versus the adjutant, how those two go together. I'm a little confused.
Every cavalry squadron has an adjutant. We call them S1s. But in order to be in the cavalry squadron, air cavalry squadron, you have to be a pilot. So the intelligence officer was a pilot. The S1, the adjutant, was a pilot. The commanding officer was a pilot. Everybody had to be, every commissioned officer had to be a pilot. So it was just a condition of the job description. We had to do our minimum flying hours just like everybody else. And that was just fun to do.
You mentioned that the pilot training was the best training you've ever received. Why is that? Can you just describe what training was like?
It was intensive, very focused. It happened every day. I had a wonderful instructor pilot. Jim Agee was his name. And I actually lived with him and his wife for a period of time during flight school. But they pushed us to the limit. And we would have contests between, you know, my instructor pilot and me as to who could do an auto rotation. That's landing without power, with your engine basically disengaged. Who we could pick a spot on the ground and see who could fly, land closest to that spot. And it was very competitive. We were also instrument qualified, which was very challenging at first to learn how to fly without being able to see anything except the instruments on your control panel. Very challenging, but when you got out, you knew that you could fly that thing.
What was it that you flew and had you before you, they taught you to fly? Excuse me. What was it, what kind of aircraft did you fly? And before you were taught, had you ever considered becoming that type of pilot?
When I was a little boy, I decided that three things I wanted to do in my life was to write for Life magazine, become an aviator, and become a lawyer. and I did all three. What did I fly? We called them Slicks and Scouts. Slicks were UH-1H or Bs or Cs or C Charlie Mikes. They were troop carrying aircraft. Scouts were the OH-58s and the OH-6, which were small aircraft designed to scout, go out and find the enemy, draw fire, and then you'd allow the attack helicopters that were above, that I did not fly, to come in and get the bad guys.
I'm sorry, I'm waiting. So they were airplanes and there were troops on them, or they were what type of aircraft?
I'm sorry, they were all helicopters.
What was it like? What was it like flying? Like, what were you feeling like? Did you feel like happy, like you're on top of the world? Like, what were you feeling? What were your emotions?
Well, I'll tell you, the happiest flying I ever had was night flying. You know, when all you could see is the stars, and you know the diamond-like lights on the ground, just very relaxing.
Now, you mentioned that you always wanted to write for Life magazine, you wanted to become a lawyer. Can you just tell me how, like, all that just came to be, considering, you know, you were a pilot at one point? How did that all play out in your life?
And did the military service have anything to do with it?
Not my military service had anything to do with it, but one of my uncle's military service did. He was a naval aviator who was lost at sea. And in World War II, and my mother just idolized him, and his picture was always on the piano. Some of his flight gear was always hanging up in the basement steps, and I wanted to be like Uncle Bill, become an aviator. And then every Wednesday night after dinner, I had to walk down with my brother to get his allergy shots. And the magazines in the doctor's office, while I waited for him to get his shots, were Life and Look. And I loved Life magazine, and I wanted to write for it. Military didn't influence that at all. I just always enjoyed writing.
When exactly did you start writing for Life and Look magazine?
I didn't write for Look. Look died a long time before I got to be able to write. I wrote one article for Life in 1994, and I was sent on assignment for another article, 97 or 98, but it didn't get published because we weren't allowed access to a certain aircraft crash scene. Police wouldn't allow us in. And if you know anything about Life magazine, it's all about the pictures, you know. But I did that article on a country vet up in Gilman, Illinois, and had a lot of fun doing that one.
Okay, now just to clarify, you became a freelance journalist before or after serving as a pilot?
After.
After. Okay, now, why did you stop being a pilot? Like, what happened?
1976, you know, the war was over. And back then, you made captain in 2 years, which is really fast. And we had more captains than the Army needed. So we had what's called a RIF, a reduction in force, and they let a bunch of captains go. I was one of them. And then I went to law school.
So what happened after the RIFT?
I applied for law school and got into Pitt at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and spent 3 years there.
What made you decide to apply to law school?
I had an English degree, and there's not a lot you can do with an English degree. You could teach or you could write. I decided to go to law school to fulfill that one of those three things I always wanted to do. And then I started freelance writing. I started the University of Illinois Alumni Magazine. I was the founding editor of that. And I wrote for the American Bar Association Journal for about 14 years as a freelancer. And I wrote for a host of other magazines, ones like Parents. You probably know Parents Magazine. I don't know, 20 or so magazines I wrote for.
Can you tell me could you describe the training you got to be able to make those calls to say, I'm going to send you to Vietnam? Talk about what training you received to make that. And you told the one story about your best friend. Can you think of another story that happened in that specific role? But start, please, with how you were told this is a job you're going to do and the kind of training you got for that job.
Had no training whatsoever for the job as an assistant adjutant. I just reported for duty. They saw I had an English degree, and they said, if you can write, you're going to sit here, and that's going to be your desk. And everything else was on the job training.
So how did you, do you remember the first call you made, the first time you had to call someone and say you're going to be going to the war?
No, I do not remember the first call. The only one that sticks in my mind is Jimmy. I mean, I made the calls to a lot of guys, but the 6th Cavalry Regiment was a replacement depot. Guys came there and went to Vietnam, or guys came back from Vietnam and got discharged. It was, you know, not a training function. I don't think we ever did any training except ride Jeeps once. Like I said, it was all on-the-job training. Thank heaven there was a manual for everything, you know.
How did you feel about the training you got regarding calling people and telling them they're going to war?
Well, I never received any training in how to do that. Like I said earlier, I got a call from Armory Branch saying Lieutenant Smith is going to jungle school and then to Vietnam. And I'd call Lieutenant Smith and say, your orders are coming. And I'd write out the orders.
When you think about the role you played in the Vietnam conflict, how do you, when you reflect back on that 40, 50 years later, what do you think about that service that you provided?
I was very proud of my service. Still am. Especially with the 1st Squadron Air 17th Cavalry. This is its unit's crest, by the way. Great bunch of guys.
Have you kept in contact with any of them? Have you ever had a reunion?
No reunions, but I did run into one of my instructor pilots, strike that Czech pilot, who cleared me for the OH-58. I ran into him at the Air and Space Museum once in Washington. Larry Hogstrat was his name. He was a funny guy. He's the only aviator I knew who had business cards made up. He said it was available. He called himself Aviator Extraordinaire, and he said he was available for bar mitzvahs and massacres.
Could you say that again? That sounds like an amazing story. I mean, I'm sorry, I just didn't hear it. He's available for what? What was that again?
Bar mitzvahs and massacres.
What does that mean?
He would fly for anything. You want to invite him to a bar mitzvah, he'd go to that. You want to invite him to a massacre, he'd go to that. But he was a funny guy.
Oh, so that wasn't alluding to the to his time in Vietnam, then?
No.
Okay.
No, it was a joke.
Okay. That's what I was wondering about.
I wanted to go back and get clarification on a few terms. If you wouldn't mind just elaborating a little bit on the difference between enlistment commission, which you went through, and then the draft.
Okay, enlisted ranks are those who don't have commissions. They're privates and sergeants. Then there's a special class between commissioned officers and enlisted men called warrant officers. And warrant officers made up the bulk of the Army's pilots. They had no command responsibilities whatsoever. Commissioned officers have command responsibility. They're platoon leaders, company commanders, all the way through generals. Selective service is something that I guess you don't have to worry about. The draft. That's how most people got into the service during the Vietnam War. They did not volunteer. They were drafted and told what they had to do. There were a lot of protests against the draft, but the protests against the draft go all the way back to the Civil War. So it's involuntary.
And how did you get in?
I'm sorry?
And what was your process through that system, that multi-layered system you just described?
I went through ROTC at Washington and Jefferson College and was commissioned as a second lieutenant on the day I graduated.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned gold bars. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything important. Could you just describe again what the gold bar was about?
The gold bars are second lieutenant. It's a gold bar on each shoulder, or if you're wearing khakis, it's on your lapel. It's just an insignia of rank. That's a second lieutenant. First lieutenant is a silver bar. Captain is two silver bars, and on up through the ranks.
And also, a little earlier, you mentioned the insignia on your shirt. I want to just...
This?
Yeah, make sure I didn't miss that either.
No, this is the unit crest for the 17th Cavalry.
Would you say that you... I know you said you didn't go to the war, but would you say that the... let me change that. Go back to Dan before the war. And then Dan after the war. What would you say is the difference between those two men and why?
Carefree before and focused afterwards. Very focused.
Why would you say more so focused?
Let me give you an example. When I went to law school, I never took a book home. I used every second of every day studying and preparing, you know, for my career. I treated it like a job, just like I treated everything in the Army as a job. It forces you to get focused. You know, you can't just walk out and quit.
After getting your orders and hearing that they were rescinded, where were you at the time, and what was it, what was your perspective on life after getting that call?
Well, I was at headquarters, 6th Cavalry, when I got the call that my orders had been canceled. And at the time, I didn't ask why. You know, I didn't really want to know why. I was just grateful. Like I said earlier, I only knew one person who really, really wanted to go to combat, you know, and that person wasn't me.
Where were you exactly stationed? Just to get that.
The 6th Cavalry Regiment was at Fort Meade in Maryland, and the 82nd Airborne, the 1st Squadron Air 17th Cavalry, was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I was also stationed at Fort Rucker in Alabama, which was the Army's flight school.
Going into the flight school and everything, did you have a plan? Were you planning on going to war? Did you, like, were you just doing it, like you said, to idolize your uncle?
Well, there were a variety of reasons why I went to flight school. One was my uncle. One was flight pay. One was I was seriously considering a 20-year career, and being a pilot doesn't hurt you when you're, you know, going up for advancement. Like I said, there were a variety of reasons why I went to flight school, not all of which had to do with my uncle, but I mean, that's where I got my start thinking about aviation as a child.
There was a lot of negativity towards the Vietnam War. Do you remember any instance or any rally that you went to or any personal experience that you went through where you felt that tension?
Yes. There was a bar in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, outside of Fort Knox, where all armor officers had to get their initial training, that had a sign in the window that said, "No servicemen or dogs." There was an incident once when I was riding in an elevator at Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh, and there was a young woman there who called me a baby killer. There were riots in Washington, D.C. in 69, and also in Detroit against the war. And basically, we were treated like dirt. You know, the civilian population, a lot of them just didn't have any respect for servicemen.
Could you go back to that day when you walked up to that store and you read that sign? What was going through your head? What were you doing previous that day? What did it look like outside? Was it?
It was summer. It was hot. It was humid. I mean, it's Kentucky. You get hot and humid in the summer. I saw the sign and I just got sick to my stomach. You know, I didn't throw up or anything. I just made me sick to compare us to dogs.
And then also, could you go back to the moment that you were talking about with the lady at the, I think you said the bar or the elevator?
I was in an elevator at Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I was in my dress greens, which are green uniform, and obviously Army. And this young lady in the elevator with me, we were the only two people in the elevator. She just looked at me and said, "Baby killer." And I didn't know what to say. I just ignored her. This may have been around the time of the My Lai massacre, with that Lieutenant William Calley, who was convicted of killing all those women and children.
Just to get a sense of like where we are in time, could you tell me once again where you were stationed and then what years of yours personally coincide with the that of Vietnam?
Well, I was in from 69 to 76, and I spent two years at Fort Meade, Maryland, and then flight school and the rest of my time at Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
Before we leave the elevator, could you, I'm just fascinated by that story, and I'm trying to picture who that woman, you said she was a young woman, you remember how old she was, you remember what she looked like, do you remember what she was wearing, or what that whole thing felt like to you?
I know that she was young, I'd say early 20s, she was attractive. Memory has it she was wearing a dress. That's about all I can remember. She had long hair.
And what did that feel like when she said that, when you had to stay in that elevator with her?
Very uncomfortable. You know, I wasn't moved to hit her or anything like that. I just didn't want to be in the elevator with her anymore.
Did you feel, I know you said you weren't, it was kind of on the job training, but did you feel any guilt behind making the phone calls when you yourself kind of dodged having to go to Nam?
I knew that question was going to come up. Sure, I felt guilt. I felt survivor's guilt. Some really nice young men that I knew got killed over there, but survivor's guilt left me. When I first held my son.
Can you tell me what that moment was like for you and why the guilt went away? Or...
And when was it?
And when was it?
Well, it was November the 11th of 82 when I first held him. And if I had been killed in Vietnam, he wouldn't have been there. And he's the finest man I know.
Would you want your son to follow you, same way you did as far as aviation? And,
No. No, he has absolutely no desire to do that. He has a good career. He's enjoying his life, and that's what I want him to do.
You mentioned riots and things in D.C. Were you in D.C. yourself, and did you experience any of those riots firsthand?
No, my unit, the 6th Cavalry, went and defended the Treasury building. But I didn't go with them. I had to stay back and do all the paperwork that adjutants do. You know, a never-ending supply of paper. This is before computers. Everything had to be done on a typewriter. And everything had to be perfect. So you can imagine how much paper you waste on a typewriter.
A lot of people refer to their friends as, I mean, you've heard the term Vietnam buddies. Would you say that you had those in a sense of war buddies or Vietnam buddies? Would you refer to them as that? Or?
No, I referred to them as friends. No, never thought of them as Vietnam buddies. You know, we didn't share that experience.
What was it like for you, like I said, after getting that phone call and I guess going back to the life that you were living, knowing that it could have been completely different, you know, without that phone call? What did you do differently? Was there anything that changed for you?
Frankly, I don't think anything really changed for me. I mean, there was that initial feeling of relief, but during that time, I was so doggone busy that I didn't have time to think about a lot of stuff.
So you mentioned the your unit going out to defend the Treasury building. We mentioned the verbal abuse you suffered. Could you just paint us a picture for, I was, you know, 6 to 8 years old at the time. So certainly for me, but certainly for these other folks in the room here, what was the country like then, and what was it like for you being in the military, living through that? What was the country? Describe America at that time, and then what was it like for you living through that?
America at that time, I think, was almost ripped apart. These riots weren't just isolated things like, you know, a Ferguson, Missouri kind of thing. These were mass riots, burning buildings. I remember one trooper that with the 6th Cav who went there told me afterwards he was so doggone mad that Jane Fonda was there mocking the troops, and they weren't even allowed to have bullets. All they had was a rifle with a bayonet. So they couldn't defend themselves or quell a riot or do anything. It just, and the 101st Airborne went to Detroit and to do a show of force, and all they were allowed to do was run in the streets, no weapons at all, just to show that there was a lot of soldiers there to stop the riots. The only times I was treated with respect by civilians, and I'll never forget these times when I'd fly commercial, and I'd wear my khakis, for example, and my wings. And when we called them stewardesses back then, they'd come back and say, "Captain, would you come up with me?" I'd go up, and she said, "You fried first class." And that happened several times to me. I thought, yeah, that's nice.
What was going through your mind at that time? I mean, compared to, I know you said the disrespect you had dealt with the lady in the elevator, and then just from other civilians, what was...
Well, I'm sorry, that wasn't an isolated incident, the lady in the elevator. I was at a bar in Mount Lebanon near Pittsburgh, and I was in my khakis, and a guy at the end of the bar looked at me and said, "What's the matter? Couldn't you find a real job?" One more beer and I think I'd have decked him. But people just treated us with such disdain.
Why didn't you hit the guy? What stopped you from...
I didn't want to go to jail. I just drank my beer and I left.
Could you describe the scene? Like what was happening that day? Did you guys interact beforehand or you just kind of out of nowhere?
Came out of nowhere.
What was on the jukebox? What did it smell like? Paint a picture for it.
Smelled like beer. There was no jukebox in that bar. It was more of a burger joint. And to this day, I can't remember what that guy looked like. All I remember is his sneer and that rude comment. It was a bar that was frequented by pirates, Pittsburgh Pirates. Baseball team. Can't remember the name of it. Probably not there anymore.
What does that do to... I'm sorry for jumping in here, but this is just so fascinating. My father, my brother served. What was that like? What does that do to you, having those people do that to you repeatedly? What does that do to a young man? What did that do to you? How did it make you feel? How did it change you?
Well, it made you not really like people. The only people I could count on were the guys that I served with. I didn't trust civilians. I don't think they liked us for whatever reason. Some really bad things happened in Vietnam, and I can understand some of their anger and some of their feelings. But some really good things also happened. I met 2 Medal of Honor winners. And that's not something you take lightly.
Could you tell me why you met those 2 Medal of Honor winners and what did they win the medals for?
One was an aviator. Well, no, actually, they were both aviators. One, and I'm going to just mention a number. I can't remember. He was a medevac pilot. A medevac pilot goes to a landing zone, picks up wounded, and takes them back to a hospital. He had multiple aircraft shot down under him in one day, and he kept getting into a new bird and flying the same missions. So he put his life at risk many, many times in one day. The other guy, who is a young lieutenant, he had been a warrant officer, got a battlefield commission. And I was just walking around Fort Knox one day, and I saw him, and I saw he only had one ribbon, and it was a Medal of Honor ribbon on his chest. I looked at him and said, "Is that the Medal of Honor?" And he said, "Yes." And I asked him what he had done, and he was scouting. He ran across a North Vietnamese Army regiment in an encampment. And he called in artillery fire on that base. And he stayed there at great risk to his own life, too, because they were trying to kill him. But he stayed there until he had to return to base. Brave guys.
What did it feel like for you to have met those 2 men, especially one coming from aviation, which I know you said you... part of that yourself?
Well, that medevac pilot just amazed me. Most people don't live through getting shot down. And he lived enough to make, I want to say he lost 9 aircraft that day. I don't know why that number sticks in my mind. But I was in awe of him. That's a lot of courage.
I'm assuming he went through the same training that you did as well. I doubt that's something they prepare you for, but do you think that you could have been in the same situation, went through the same, or done the same things, or would you have to rely on training, or is it more of an instinct?
I think when he was doing what he was doing, he was running on adrenaline, you know, that day. I don't think he thought about it. I don't think anybody thinks I'm going to be a hero today, you know. I think he was just running on adrenaline. Can I tell you one other story that you might find interesting?
Go for it.
When I was going through flight school, the first female aviator in the Army's history was in my group, in my class. And everybody was thinking she was going to fail because she was a girl. I flew with her a couple times. She had a great control touch. She was a good aviator and a very nice young lady. Her name was Sally Woolfolk at the time. Now it's Sally Murphy. And if you pick up a history of the Vietnam War, you'll see her picture. Because, you know, she made it as an aviator.
Can you tell me what, were you guys, you said you guys were close, correct?
I'm sorry, please?
You did say you guys were close, correct?
Close?
Yeah, like friends, real acquaintances.
Oh, Sally and I?
Yes.
Yeah. We got to be friends.
What training was like for her and what was it like going through the aviation program?
Well, it was...
I'm sorry. It's interesting, but it's not really... We don't have time. Could we... Nate, you remember we were talking in the green room about the names on the wall? Mm-hmm. And can we get into that a little bit?
You mean the Vietnam Wall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The memorial.
You mentioned the wall and the, you know, deaths of the American soldiers. Did you ever, looking at that wall, did it ever cross your mind about the Vietnamese that died as well? And did you ever feel a certain way about them the same way that you did about the American soldiers?
No. I didn't feel the same way at all. I saw the traveling wall down in Sadorus or Tolono or somewhere down there, south of Champaign. They had a traveling wall. It's kind of a miniaturized version. And the names are grouped by dates, you know, who died on what days. And I went through there and I found two or three of the guys I knew. But there are 57,000 names on that wall. Gosh. They weren't just names. One kid that, I've never used this term to describe a guy before, but he was the sweetest guy I ever knew. He was... helped train us at the armor school when we were brand new lieutenants.